Hello and welcome to the Echo Chamber Podcast. My name is Tony Groves, and today we are talking about the children and the parents. And it's called Parents United, but like it is just one family unit, and it is something that needs to be discussed. Martin, just before we start, you have been working your arse off the last number of years, obviously, on the own thing. But can I ask, I want to get this in now, because I'm hearing rumours that there's people who don't want you at the PAC in the next couple of weeks, Martin.
Yeah. I'll be putting. I said I'd put up a thread to bring people up to date last night on Twitter, but I got too tired and fell asleep. So I'll put it up tonight, and we'll explain where we're at with the PAC at the moment, and it'll just give people a flavour of what's going on in there. If I just say as well that Oliver Connor is here with us today. And myself and Olive are part of a group of a dozen whistleblowers who work together to help and assist each other in getting through the processes. And thanks, Olive, for coming along. It's nice to see one of the whistleblower groups here with us.
Thank you for having me.
Listen, I do need to do a bit of housekeeping, guys. We're putting together another series of podcasts. We are live again on Sunday. Come along, register, come along, have a bit of fun. And we're hoping to be joined by another new Tortoise Shack contributor who will be launching a podcast soon. So all should be revealed on Sunday, and we see how things go. Anyway, enough plugging our own stuff. We are delighted to be joined by as two members of Parents United. And so we're joined by Zara Flynn, who is a registered counselling psychologist and a mother of three. And as you've already heard, Olive O'Connor, who's an international healthcare advocate and a mother of four. Ladies, you're very welcome to the podcast.
Thank you. Delighted to be here, and it's great to have anybody listen to this story that we have to share, because there's been a little bit of silence on the press side of things.
Well, before we get into that, do you want to just give listeners a synopsis of what the Parents United report has done? Actually, it's funny enough, Martin, you mentioned it on Sunday, at the last Sunday show, and you recommended people go to read it. So,
anyway, I know there's a mammoth amount of work gone into it, Tony, an absolute mammoth amount of work.
Oh, I know, but it's just, I would like Olive, if you could give us a couple of minutes, just a rundown of what's the basis of it, and what are the key findings, I suppose?
Yeah, so essentially, I suppose, from my own perspective, I have four kids who are all within high risk, very risk categories, as is my husband and myself. So I suppose the foundation of it is two of my girls got swine flu many years ago, and they have been left with long-term symptoms. So I've been really interested in, I suppose, research with children, especially with COVID-19, and the fact that we are sending our children into schools. I came across some amazing moms and parents and school staff, part of Parents United. And while I was, you know, I suppose strong enough to say I'm taking my children out of school and they're not going back in until it's safe, I found along the way that there was lots and lots of children in the same situation who are living with very high risk family members, but they were denied access to remote learning from school. So that to me was the first kind of, oh my God, there's something wrong here. So as two of my girls did go in when community transmission was low, I kept a close eye on the numbers. And that's when I first realized we have a very serious problem on our hands. The first problem was that we didn't actually have the data. So we had children's age groups, school children age, thrown in with adults. So I wasn't actually able to see what was going on within schools. Our school reports weren't released until nearly 8 weeks after schools reopened. Yet we were reliant on what the government were telling us that schools were safe. And when I started kind of looking at the school reports, I found that the positivity rates that they kept saying were low sometimes weren't. Sometimes they were higher than our community. And they would word that a different way on the press. And then when I actually tried to find school-aged children data, I couldn't find it on the normal kind of reports. I couldn't find it on the COVID hub. And eventually I came across a little tiny table at the bottom of a school report, and it looked fine until I subtracted one number from the other. And what I actually found scared the life out of me. So what I found was in the 6 months when schools were closed, there were 1,176 cases in children under 18. In the 4 months when schools reopened, there were 13,143 cases in children under 18. And when I looked at that and I thought, oh my God, that's a very short space of time, what I found most scarily was the highest increase in cases was in school age children, age 5 to 18. And then I found in hospitalizations, which is an even harder piece of data to find there on those age groups, the only age groups which had the highest increase in hospitalizations after schools reopened were school age children. In fact, all adults had lower hospitalizations after schools reopened than when they were closed. This to me was like alarm bells ringing in my head. First of all, why weren't we told about this? Like, this should have been at press briefings. The unions should have been told about this. Teachers, schools, staff, parents should have been told about this. We weren't. I found it literally a lot of hard work and no sleep for 2 or 3 months. Very important for me. But most importantly was, I suppose, listening to what people were telling me. And people kept saying, if you're in a school, you will not be told if there's a case of a of COVID-19 in your classroom or school. So I kept listening to what people were saying. So myself and Deirdre Gilhawley were both members of Parents United. We decided we were going to take this piece of work and look at international policies and compare it. And we found that our definition of a close contact in a school is not aligned with the ECDC, WHO or CDC guidelines. You are supposed to be defined as a close contact in a classroom because it's a high risk exposure. Our definition says if you're wearing a mask or if there's good ventilation or if there's good infection prevention control, whatever that means, that you may not be classed as that. And this scared me because my children did go back, two of my girls went back last September. And had I known that that was the policy at the time, I would never have sent them in. What if they were in a class with somebody with COVID, they came back to my three-year-old who's expecting heart surgery and they potentially gave that to her or they got sick themselves. So that was the basis of the report. We wanted to share what other people didn't know and we wanted to share the risks. People aren't aware of the risks.
Yeah.
Sarah, if I can go to you straight away, I can see you're nodding your head there. What are your main takeaways from the research and the work?
Yeah, so like I'm so glad anyway, for starters, to have found Olive and Parents United, you know, and, you know, it just what it shows is that there are so many people out there who are being unheard, who are frightened, you know, and who live in fear of threat, you know, like everybody in society at the moment. We have this invisible threat coming down the tracks. We don't know where it's lurking, you know, and everybody's just doing what they want to do and need to do to protect their loved ones. And so to find out that, you know, that government and public health strategies and the ambiguities around all of that are just compounding these feelings of threat in society. You know, it's having such a huge impact. And then to impact on the school environment, and, you know, we've all heard a lot being said about mental health and education and that they're both so intertwined. Yet what isn't being spoken about is the nuances around that, you know, and the individuality around that and the context around that as well, because this is all very contextual and it needs to consider each family and each family system and the fragility and vulnerability of those that, you know, they're just, it's all being swept under the carpet. There's a veil of silence. There's, you know, there's an element of shaming that goes with that as well. And people are just afraid to talk about it, you know, even in my own profession. You know, and I'm coming from it, obviously, from a unique perspective of being a professional, mental health professional and a parent and also a daughter and, you know, a wife. And, you know, so and, you know, I'm also the daughter of a very seriously compromised mother who lives alone, and I've been trying to protect her and was delighted to hear the government, you know, releasing a support bubble strategy, only to hear that there were you know, serious limitations around that, and that it wasn't actually considering vulnerable, very high risk family members. And when it comes to children going into school, that really needs to be given the paramount focus. It's imperative to give that a focus. Otherwise, that threat of fear is still bubbling, you know, under the surface, and people don't know what to do. People are confused and distressed.
Can I come in there, come back to you for a second, Olive? Conspiracy silence around this. So you have crunched the numbers. You have come up with the fact that we are not counting cases in schools the same as everybody else in the EU is counting cases in schools. We're outside of what the ECDC has said. And you released all of this data, and it is a mammoth deep dive of data. I can say that because I've read it. You released this about a week ago, and I presume it's been front page news. Every newspaper has picked it up. Every politician has jumped up and said, this is disgraceful. We should be telling people the truth. What has happened?
Nothing. Nothing has happened. We've basically, we sent this out in two separate press releases purposefully. We sent, you know, a press release with two different headlines to see, you know, would it grab attention. We sent it over 200 people were sent this in the press. We've received responses from, I would say, a very few, a handful of journalists. A few of them have tried to get this released, and a few of them have told me that it just hasn't happened. This really, really, really bothers me. First of all, in the first instance, I'm qualified to write a report like this. I am a qualified healthcare advocate. I am deemed as a mom of four without people recognizing the fact I have two international fellowships in healthcare. I have trained across numerous areas, and I'm qualified to do risk assessments, which is part of this report. And it seems that the only way the press will listen is if it's somebody really, really opposition, such as, you know, anyone who's calling for zero COVID. That's the way I would see it. Most importantly, I think there's a lot of personal bias, if I was to be really honest with you, Martin. I think what we have is employers who want their staff to work normal hours. So if their children are at home with them, they can't actually do their jobs properly. And the employers, maybe in the press, maybe lots of different areas, including politicians. And they're like, oh God, you know, if our kids at home, we can't do our job. That's personal bias. And I understand that. It's really, really tough working from home. It's really tough working from home with children. I've been cocooning for a year. But that's not the point. The point is, if we do not have safe schools, if our children and school staff are not protected, people are going to get really sick. They're going to die. And what people don't realize is cases go up. The science tells us the R number goes up when schools open. The R number comes down when schools close, along with other things. And you know what that leads to? Every time we have more cases, lockdown. And that impacts everyone.
Can I just come in there? Because we spoke about this before, you and I, Olive, and your main concern was access to online resources for children who are in vulnerable families. And it's that access to online learning that's the reason you started down this road in the first place. Yeah. Is it the case that children who should be at home are going to school on the advice of the government, the flawed advice of the government, and that they are putting their families in immediate risk? Is that the case?
That is the case. And I'll let Zara come in after me on this, because she'll tell you some of kind of the mental health impact from this. I'll give you an example of flawed advice. Two nights ago at about 6:30 on television, the national our national emergency a member of it said very clearly that children rarely transmit to other children or rarely transmit COVID to other adults. That is absolutely not true. It is absolutely not true. It's not true based on data. across Ireland, UK, the whole world. Rare is a very dangerous word to use, because we know, to give you an example, right, of showing you that this is the situation, okay? The Princeton study, the largest study in the whole world, right, 500,000 people, said children are most likely to get it from other children their own age. It said children transmitted at the same rate as adults. UK data right beside us, next door to us, okay? This is what their equivalent to Netflix said, right? Their sage. Children aged 2 to 16 are more likely to be the first person to bring COVID into the home and twice as likely to spread it to others in the home compared to adults, right? This is actual science based on their data, based on what we don't have and we can't see. Yesterday, Dr. Deepti Gurdasani, an amazing epidemiologist, was able to say, even with the great data they have in the UK, that's even flawed. And the way it's interpreted is being flawed, or is biased, I should say. When we have people in our national emergency team telling everybody publicly, that's been shared through our broadcaster, that it's rare for children to transmit, people don't know the risks. And yesterday, again, in government, in the Dáil, Minister Noma Foley cited this and said that schools were safe environments. No, they're not. They can't be, because our national guidelines are 2 meters apart. Our national guidelines are avoid crowded environments. Our national guidelines are wear masks. None of that is happening in schools. And yet they call it a safe environment based on a flawed statement, such as children don't transmit. Has everybody forgotten children live with adults? Children are with adults in schools. School staff are adults. Everybody seems to have forgotten this, and it's so dangerous.
And the line that's used is that children don't suffer from it as well. That's the line. So, and I suppose to come into use are what that means in terms of that line. Such a broad sentence when you consider the families and extended families that these children are returning to from their bubbles, or whatever terminology we're going to use in it, because they're effectively, if they're in a class of 24, they're in 24 other bubbles in reality. If you're a parent of someone who has a vulnerable sibling, child, parent, you know, this situation over the last 12 months must be just causing all sorts of undue stress for people.
Yes. And you consider suffering, you have to consider each child's suffering. You know, it's all so different. COVID-19 worry is, as it's so called, you know, now as well in the mental health field, is a very big thing, and it's not being considered in any of these policies or any of this discourse that's happening around schools and education and mental health for children and their families, you know. And so there is this dichotomy emerging, you know, so there's this split-sided sort of response to this in and around the narrative, and it can become very black and white, you know, and it's not, because, you know, the dialogue is creating this kind of split thinking around an issue. You know, and I think that's indicative, okay, of the multifaceted nature of this, right? It's very complex. There are so many different vulnerabilities and individuals to consider. But, you know, like, I just feel that I can sense the frustration building up. I can sense it for the person, you know, the politician who wants to get their kid back into school. I can, you know, and versus the person that we know all of, you know, who are terrified of sending their children to school, because the government is saying, you take that risk, you know, you take that risk, and, you know, we'll reassure you that schools are safe and that they're, you know, a place that they are protected. But at the end of the day, the choice and the decision needs to rest with the parent, the family, their system, that they're, you know, their community. It needs to rest with the individuals to make that decision. and not to be forced down this rabbit hole, or even, you know, like I was just discussing it with someone else, and you know, we were saying, when all you have is a hammer, all you're going to see is a nail, you know, and this is what is happening, and it's putting people in very impossible, stressful situations. And you know, we consider it, like, from a putting my psychologist hat back on, you know, which I take it on and off. There's the whole idea of the autonomic system, the autonomic nervous system, and polyvagal theory. And we have, you know, the vagus nerve running, connecting our brainstem to our gut, you know, telling us, informing us in subtle, nuanced ways how to behave in a situation that feels dangerous, that feels threatening. And for each person, they will make their own assessments on what that fear or threat might be. And they will do it and evaluate their situation as they do it. So for one person, you know, like I'm thinking of some of the people in Parents United, you know, there's scenarios there where there's single parents with children with profound disabilities, and having another child who would benefit from being able to attend school or receiving online learning. And they're being put in the very difficult decision to keep that child out of school. It's not something they're doing lightly, because again, they're taking on the extra burden of, you know, caring for their education when their hands are already very full.
And yet, as you pointed out earlier, people say, keep repeatedly say schools are a safe environment. Now, again, to broaden it out, yeah, again, to say the science doesn't back that up, because we've seen the likes of the science evolving, because we've seen people talk about what are we doing in terms of to make them safer? Have we, like, we could have spent a couple of million quid to put air quality, to put ventilation systems in to check the quality of the air and the air transmission, and how it moves. It's not a lot of money. I think Orla Hegarty worked it out at 2 million quid on a lot of devices that would have covered every national school in the country. You know, this is not mega money. And we've had nearly 12 months to do a lot of this. And if I could even be broader again and bring it out just for listeners' benefit, there's over 872 million children who've lost out on school in terms of school closures across the globe. It's nearly a billion children. And that's why when you say, Zara, it's multifaceted. They're losing out in so many ways. They're losing out on you know, that system. But unfortunately, the overriding system seems, listening to you guys, and maybe you can tell me I'm being unfair, is that there's people like me at home who are going, oh God, get them out from underneath my feet. I need them back at school.
This is also relevant, you know, and it's not to undermine individuals in that situation, because, you know, mental health and stress and how we, you know, how we experience that is all very relative. You know, so what is a threat in terms of, you know, should my child go into school, should my child stay out? It's up to the individual to make that assessment. You know, it's up to the family system to make that assessment based on their needs. And once the family as a unit is content with the decision they've been able to make, then the children will be okay, because they only struggle when they see the adults around them struggling and flailing.
And it has to be an informed decision, of course. That's the big thing. Olive, you wanted to come in there.
Yeah, so I think, like, it's really important that we get this across. So, you know, I'm so tired of people saying, oh, you want the schools to close. No, that's not what we're saying at all. What we're saying is that education and health should not be competing with each other. Safety comes first over both. It comes over everything we do. But what we're actually saying is, right now in Ireland, so people are really clear of this, if you want to keep your child at home from school, your child will not be entitled to remote learning from their school. And what that's led to is many parents having to deregister their children from the public school roll book which can eventually lead to them being permanently deregistered or losing their place in the school. Okay, what we're asking for is if the government can allow people to make the choice whether they send their child to school or not, okay, and the same for staff who are in very, very serious positions, okay, if they allow people to keep their children home from school, they should be allowed to get remote learning. And by default, and we talk about mitigation, Tony, that you said earlier on, by default, if we have children at home, we reduce our class sizes. That is an immediate mitigation. So what we need to do is give them more distancing, give them more space. We have the biggest class sizes in Europe, the biggest. We need to get that smaller. The WHO, ECDC, all say a few things, right? Reduce class sizes immediately, especially with two big things, high community transmission and loads of new variants that we know a little about, okay? Children in Ireland are being denied that. We have staff, pregnant staff, right? We have staff high risk. When I say high risk, they've got multiple conditions, heart diseases, blood pressure, you name it, told to go in to an environment that doesn't have the same mitigations as any other workplace. Not, and when I tell you how dangerous it is, it's so dangerous. So what I'm saying is we need to start putting in the mitigations that are there by ECDC. And to be very, very clear on this one, ECDC and the WHO are written in our statute book. They're under the new amended Act of COVID-19 as advisors to the government, to the Minister for Health and to NPHET. Furthermore, they're written in the NPHET governance structure, and yet they're not being listened to. So we need to get really clear, really serious. Do not force people into an environment where they don't have the same protections as anybody else, and at the same time ensure people's right to living or earn a living and people's right to access education from the public system is not denied from them. That's what we need to get down to.
If I can just come in there and say, in regard to the government, in this situation, the government is also an employer. You know, and they and teachers are employees of the state. So there is an onus on government to use the correct data to protect their employees. And there's also an onus on unions to ensure that government are using the correct data to protect their employees. And I get what Tony was saying about lots of parents sitting at home saying, oh, tearing their hair out. Yeah. And the government are manipulating that.
Yes.
False data, and that's unforgivable. They're manipulating that, and very understandable, trying to get some work done, parents trying to get some work done.
Yeah.
Very, very understandable. But the government are manipulating that sentiment with false data to pull everybody on the side of opening schools and reducing online learning when it's simply not safe to do so. Zara, what do you think can be done to put the situation right?
Yeah, well, there's a challenge, you know. Well, if this pandemic has taught us anything, it's the importance of having robust health and education systems, you know, in the country. So really, like, we have to get down to the nuts and bolts of it, you know, but that's like there's decades of dereliction involved in terms of getting that back or into any sort of useful shape to begin with. I suppose we need to be able to access the services. You know, we need to be able to, there's a continuity in schooling, you know, paper that was released by the government, by the Department of Education in September, you know, showing that children who have vulnerabilities themselves with their health, can access and can have remote learning. So by extension, it's just to be able to apply that to other vulnerable individuals that fall into that category, and also to include those who have family members who are vulnerable, and not to have it so restrictive as well, because, you know, vulnerability is a vulnerability, you know. And there shouldn't be levels of it, you know.
Yeah, well, yeah, that was something I was going to come to, and it's back again to the remote learning, is that they have classified kids according to a chart or a whatever they want to call it on vulnerability, but some vulnerabilities are seen as more important than other vulnerabilities. I suppose asthma is one good example. We know that's a factor in COVID, but it's not a vulnerability that allows for online learning, which is very strange when it is a predominant factor in Ireland, and it's also a predominant factor in how people deal with COVID. Yeah. How do we get the message across to government that, look, just open up online learning? It's as easy to open it up for one as it is for 1,000. You know, there is no great difficulty in upscaling that. How do we get that message through, Olive?
I think it just comes back to, look, we've been in lockdown for weeks and weeks. We've seen all our children get access. No, it's not all fair across, not everybody's been getting it the right way. But I'll give you an example. My two daughters, you know, my three eldest, I should say, have been accessing schoolwork since last October when I took them out before the cases got very high again. Our school have been brilliant in my eldest girls have been accessing remote learning. It's very simple. They log into Microsoft Teams. They're there. They can't see the class. They can hear the class. They can see everything. This is not the stuff made of, you know, dreams. But what I will say is this. It doesn't suit everybody, Martin. Like, you know, we know this remote learning doesn't suit everybody.
Yeah, we do.
We need to be very clear. Are the children in our country, excuse me, that are... we have children who have special educational needs, but not just children special educational needs, children who are maybe in very violent situations at home, children who they may, you know, have very poor English and things like that, right? Those children may need to be in school, right? That's absolutely fine. And maybe, like, you know, parents who are reliant on putting bread on the table, they have to work to just pay the bills, okay? This comes back to government to say, you have a government as a, you have a duty of care to support people when schools close. You have a duty of care if somebody can't send their child in, right? What we're asking for is the simplest of things. Give people the choice. If the teachers don't have enough staff to provide remote learning, that falls on the government to ensure that they get that. If they can't do it themselves, then very simply, there's loads of great private companies out there that can actually provide remote learning or whatever the case might be. If that's what they need to do for the interim, they need to do that now, because this, we've the biggest issues of forcing people. The worst thing I've ever heard is a little girl say to me, I've pains in my belly going into school in the morning, I've pains in my belly coming out of school in the evening, I'm afraid to give it to somebody else. All right, that is an awful position to put a child. That is not good for their mental health, Martin. So what we need to do is be really, really clear and say, let's provide something that makes it safer for all. We can't have pregnant or high-risk staff going into environments that are unsafe. We can't do this to people. And when you say, you know, false data, I'm not going to say the data is false. I'm going to say it's not there. And the data that is there isn't being shared. I'll say policy is wrong. Policy is 100% incorrect. But the data that's there, it is there, Martin. I asked for it and I was charged €500 to get data on school-age children and staff that should be there already. I rang this morning asking, you know, where is this? You know, I'm happy to pay for it. And I've been told it's going to take weeks just to let me know, just because they need to find out how much work has to be put into it. I mean, come on, come on. And unions, you said unions are reliant on this, Martin. Unions, unfortunately, can only challenge them back if they know the data, but they're being told stuff and fed information that isn't the full picture. So I'm hoping the report that's there, the unions will go through it, they'll read it, they'll really hear what's being said in it, and they'll use that to challenge back and say, hold on a second before you tell us to go ahead on the 15th of March. Hold on, we need to look at this before we make a decision.
Yeah, and if I can come in on that one, it's also like the studies out there, you know, that government are relating to, referring to, you know, like we have to remember as well that these studies are all very divergent. You know, we can find evidence to support whatever sort of approach or perspective we want to, you know, to strengthen. So I think what, you know, people need to be made aware of is that, you know, yes, there is evidence out there to suggest that children and young people have experienced an increase in emotional and behavioural difficulties during COVID-19 with restrictions and school closures and all of that. But there is equally evidence out there to suggest that children with those same emotional and behavioural difficulties have actually improved in their mental health outcomes by being at home with their families, not having to go into a stressful school environment, which was stressful for them in the first place. You know, and I'm talking about a lot of children here with sensory processing difficulties and, you know, social anxiety. So, you know, that's one aspect of it. And then, you know, there are the individuals that do need to have those, you know, one-to-one supports for them and the behavioural needs as well. And we can also find evidence to show that actually this has opened up new possibilities for children and adolescents. You know, there's been a lot of things that, you know, the youth have learned, you know, and that we, I think, as adults have learned as well. You know, and you know, even bringing in the idea of family connectedness, you know, that has been studied.
I think that's a great point, Sarah. And I've been watching some of the studies on mental health because we won't know for years. Our figures and our analysis will not be in for years. But in other countries, like in Australia, in Melbourne, where they had that prolonged lockdown, they've already crunched their figures and they saw a reduction in suicides. Now, I know that's not, that doesn't explain everything. But then again, in the United States, when they were looking at excess deaths, and this is a report that only came out yesterday, they also saw a reduction in suicide. So it's a mixed bag as far as mental health is concerned, and there are some bad faith players there who are just using it as a stick. But as a professional, you see that it's a mixed bag, and we just simply won't be able to draw those conclusions for years to come.
Come on in.
I want to say, yeah, I saw that study, Martin, yesterday, and even it was Tyler Black. He is actually an emergency psychiatrist that deals with children. That actually, that's what he does every single day. He's a brilliant. And we've quoted him in our report. He was actually not really sure about it himself. He was like, "Oh my God, is this true?" Because this is. But again, he verified it again this morning. He's like, "Yes, it is actually true." He made a very brilliant piece on Twitter, and he basically just said, you know. You know, you want your child to go to bed. He's just making an analogy. You want your child to go to bed and you're having a big fight with them, you know, and then they go into the room, they lock the door, and then they threaten, you know, "I'm going to overdose." He said, "What's more important, them going to bed or the fact that they could take their own life?" It changes immediately. It's about safety. It's always about safety. That's what he really drills home. And I think that's where we need to go. Can I just say, in relation to mental health as well and children, right? What a lot of people don't realize is that the statistics, and this isn't just in the UK now, there's a lot of stuff coming out in this world, nothing in Ireland, mind you, but a lot of stuff across the world, that 1 in 8 children under the age of 12 will have symptoms after getting COVID, will have symptoms for more than 5 weeks, right? That 1 in 7 children between 12 and 18 will have symptoms after 5 weeks of COVID. They will still have these symptoms. And 1 in 10 adults have symptoms for 3 months and longer. Right, this is called a thing called long COVID, that the governments in the UK won't recognise as being a condition or a disease or anything like that. That brings me back to my girls having swine flu for years, 12 years, they still have all this impact from it. You know, people can say, "Oh, it's only a bit of a cough or a cold." Can you imagine having a cough for 24/7 for 5 weeks, or a headache for 24/7 for 5 weeks? These are children and adults we're talking about. We need to stop using the measurement as death, or the measurement is just hospitalization. We need to realize that COVID-19 can leave people with long-term symptoms that impacts their mental health, that will long-term impact their education. My girls have missed hundreds of days of school from being sick from it, from their virus, very similar. And we need to understand that, again, in the long term, is again going to impact our health system, because all of those people will need to get diagnostics and scans and medicines and all those things. And yet we're sending everybody in.
I think that's a good point to leave it. Zara and Olive, thank you very much for coming on and having this chat with us today. It's been informative. Let's hope that something comes from it. Tony.
No, I just... Just the idea, I think what's most important to take away from this conversation and why the data is so important is that it's not as simple as, you know, I'm fortunate that, say, I don't at the moment, I'm in a house with four bedrooms, so my two kids can have their own space and we can do all of these things. They're at a certain age where I'm not dependent upon a child, you know, someone to do childcare. I don't have someone who is considered vulnerable within my 5K sort of thing. So I have all of those benefits. But my God, we all know someone who does. We all have someone else, and everybody's situation is different, and different is unique. And it, I suppose, the main call here is to give people the choice. See how we've had these people talk about the choice that we need for leave and cert, whether you wanted to go through predicted grades or you wanted to sit the exam or whatever the situation is. We need to think about that in these terms as well, because there are families right now that feel that they don't have a choice to make. And that is actually what's wrong. And it's people need to wake up to the fact that just because it's not the 6 inches in front of your nose doesn't mean that it's not impacting people who you know, who you love, and who you care about. So I suppose that's the big takeaway I have for this, because it really does seem like people feel that the choices have been denied them. And also get the data, because the data actually is there. So fair play to you. It's a big piece of work. So we do appreciate you doing that piece of work. Listeners, look, go. We'll post it. We'll post the links to it on this. Have a look at it. Have a read of it. Make up your own minds. And we will talk to you all soon. Take care. Bye bye.
Thank you.
Tony and Martin, Martin and Tony, speaking to interesting people only. It's the Echo Chamber podcast. Subscribe now on Patreon.